from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's all about... Well, Michael Deaver, I think, gave us the clue when he was running imagery for President Reagan. He was famously reported to have said, "You take the words and you give me the images, and I'll win." So this week, whatever the words of the president's speech, I was in Deaver mode watching the pictures. And I'm sure you noticed, as well as I and everyone else did, that the president was delivering the speech in a new location and in a new staging, so to speak. I bring my show business lingo to the job here. First of all, unlike most presidential addresses, serious, you know, presidential addresses, I'm being charitable here, he was standing. He wasn't sitting. Now, you may remember, I sure do, when Tom Brokaw started standing during the NBC Nightly News, and then soon after, Dan Rather followed on the CBS Evening News, and now, of course, all the anchors stand and sit and basically do everything except go on Dancing with the Stars to deliver the news. But I do remember the months and months and months of painful awkwardness as these guys who were used for their entire professional anchoring lives to sitting down now had to get used to the idea of standing and, God forbid, even walking while they were delivering the news. For no good reason. They weren't going anywhere. They weren't getting up to go anywhere. It was just to look different. Okay, so same reason. But here's the president, who's not really delivered a major address standing before, and, you know, maybe the biggest speech of his career. He's asked to do it in a new piece of staging. And then they put him in the White House library. That's the new location. Now, you understand why they wanted a new location. They wanted visually to say, hey, we're doing something new, so that even if the strategy, the new way forward, got picked apart as something not very new, the imagery said new, just like a big red new on the box. But it's the White House library. And, you know, for better or worse, ladies and gentlemen, half the people watching the president deliver a speech in a room with a wall behind him lined with books are going to be totally distracted thinking, those books are all copies of my pet goat. You know, if you want to put him in a new place, the White House kitchen. Hey, we're cooking up something new. The White House bathroom. We're flushing the old policy. The White House pool. We're trying to keep the Iraqi government afloat. Something. Except the place where you just say, okay, that's another copy of my pet goat. And then you have John McCain. Now, John McCain's doing something, ladies and gentlemen, that's, I don't know if it's admirable, but it certainly is amazing. He's running for president while supporting an exceedingly unpopular war. You got to, you know, got to give the guy credit for either bravery, stupidity, or a combination of the both. But he's out there basically pumping for this policy, this new way forward. And he's saying something interesting, which I don't know if that's part of the White House talking points, but it's certainly part of John McCain's talking points, which is, you know, it is part of the Republican strategy to say to the Democrats, well, what's your plan? Now, Dick Cheney made it very clear on Fox News Sunday that Congress has a role to play. And we're very interested in their opinions. Meaning, you know, even if you came up with a plan. But nonetheless, it's kind of a schoolyard bluff. What's your plan? Show me yours. And the Democrats, we'll see what they say. We'll see what they do. But John McCain is saying, you know, if we were to do what John Murtha recommends and start pulling out or redeploying, is I think the appropriate word. The people who are proposing that plan have a responsibility, says John McCain, for telling the American people all the catastrophic things that, in his opinion, may follow a redeployment. ethnic cleansing, greater involvement by neighboring nations in the affairs of Iraq. A list of horribles. The only odd thing is, it's exactly the list of things that has happened in the wake of the administration's decision to invade Iraq. And I don't hear John McCain saying, nor did I hear him saying then, you got to tell the American people about all the horrible things that could happen if you start this war. Only if you end it. Maybe he should be in the library. Hello, welcome to the show.
Nothing but money.
Hour, 9 to 5, it starts in the p.m. And I love the sunrise, so I step out in the a.m. The street is black and shiny from the nightly rain. The glory of the light brings evaporation. Mornings, fresh, oxygen, cleanest. I take a deep hit, help my mind stay the greenest. I'm already awake, so I'm not drinking coffee. Don't want a cigarette, cause it's a form of slavery. Walk into the store, cause I need a few items. The sun heats my blood, like a hit of vitamins. I need to buy some food for my dreads. I can't remember why, but I need a spool of thread. Well, a man with dirty dreads, he steps around the corner. He asks me for a dime, a nickel or a quarter. I don't have any change, so I'm stepping along. But as I'm walking past, he sings to me a song. There's a hole in the bucket
to eat my winter in it.
Realize that. There's a hole in the bucket
to eat the winter in it.
Realize that. Realize
that. There's
a hole in the bucket
to eat the winter in it.
Realize that.
Realize that.
There's a hole in the bucket
to eat the winter in it.
Realize that. Realize that. Well, the day's picking up, cause I'm humming the song. The buses and the people all keep moving along. To the shopkeeper, I say, what's up? And I'm thinking about the man who's holding up the cup. I pay for all the stuff and get a pocket full of change. Well, should I give it to the man's a question in my brain. What's gonna happen if I give the man a dime? I don't wanna pay for another brother's wine. What's gonna happen if I give the man a quarter? Will he find a dealer and try to place an order? What's gonna happen if I give the man a nickel? Will he buy some food or some pork that's been pickled? I'm not responsible for the man's depression. How can I find compassion in the midst of a recession? How can all these questions keep up with my head? And I still can't remember why I need a spool of thread. There's a hole in the bucket
to eat the winter in it.
Dear Eliza,
glory to God.
There's a hole in the bucket
to eat the winter in it.
Dear Eliza, dear Eliza,
glory to God.
There's a hole in the bucket
to eat the winter in it.
Dear Eliza,
glory to God.
But there's a hole in the bucket
to eat the winter in it.
Dear Eliza,
dear Eliza.
As I'm walking past, I'm trying to avoid him because I know he's gonna ask me about the coinage that is in my pocket, but I don't know if I should put it in his pocket. I walk right past to think about it more. Back at the crib, I'm opening up the door. A pocket full of change, it don't mean a lot to me. My cup is half full, but his is empty. I put back on my cap and I start heading back. I reach into my pocket and I have a heart attack. Well, as I'm digging deep, I scream, oh no, there's nothing in the pocket but a great big hole. Well, I was busy thinking if he would buy a smack. The jingle in my pocket slipped through the cracks. No one has a change and it's fucking up my head. But now I know the reason why I had to buy the thread. Cause there's a hole in the bucket
to eat the winter in it.
Dear Eliza,
there's
a hole.
To eat the winter in it.
Dear Eliza,
glory to God.
There's a hole in the
bucket.
From the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And, you know, President Bush admitted, said if there were mistakes in the Iraq war policy, those were his responsibility. But he did not elucidate upon them or elaborate upon them in the speech. However, according to the Washington Post, the White House put out a chart that compared past key assumptions with current ones, showing how the situation has changed. In the past, the chart said the White House believed political progress will help defuse the insurgency. Now it's concluded that political and economic progress are unlikely without a basic level of security. Huh. In the past, the White House assumed the majority of Iraqis will support the coalition and Iraqi efforts to build a democratic state. Now it says Iraqis are increasingly disillusioned with coalition efforts. Huh. It's almost like the reporters were right. The chart went on to say the White House wrongly assumed that dialogue with insurgents groups would reduce violence, that other countries in the region have a strategic interest in a stable Iraq, and that Iraqi security forces were gaining strength to handle threats. Those were the bad old assumptions. Now it says dialogue has not worked, Arab states have not fully supported the Iraqi government, and many Iraqi forces are not yet ready to handle the security threat. Huh. It's like they were suddenly started reading the media. Wow. The hearings have begun, which is all I expect from the Democratic control of Congress. Hearings. Give me some hearing. Give me some good TV. But in his confirmation hearing, new Secretary of Defense Robert Gates gave what I think is an interesting, if not new, certainly novel and provocative explanation for why we went into Iraq in the first place.
Saddam, if he didn't have weapons of mass destruction, would move quickly to try and obtain them. And I think we have to look at the reality in terms of why we all thought that. This is a little bit of a diversion, but I think one of the reasons why Iran is determined to have nuclear weapons is that they see how complicated it is for us to try and deal with a North Korea that has nuclear weapons. And I think they believe that if Saddam had had a nuclear weapon, we might not have attacked him in either 1990 or 2001, or 1991 or 2001. So there was no doubt, and I believe Saddam had the same calculus. And so once the sanctions were lifted, there was no doubt in my mind that he would strive to get a nuclear weapon. He clearly hadn't changed his spots in the slightest, and so that's the reason that I supported the decision to go in.
So we had to go in to keep him from getting a nuclear weapon, because if he got a nuclear weapon, we couldn't go in. That's what I got out of it. You tell me if I'm wrong. He thought, like the North Koreans or the Iranians, that, if you get a nuclear weapon, the Americans can't invade you. So we have to invade to prevent him from getting a nuclear weapon, or else we won't be able to invade. It's cool. It's cool in here. Ladies and gentlemen, news of our friend Pakistan, Dateline Karachi. Democracy is Pakistan's internal issue, and Washington does not interfere in the internal affairs of any country. That's from U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan, Ryan C. Crockett, soon, by the way, to be our new ambassador to Iraq. We'll see if he thinks we should interfere in the internal affairs of that country. So he's indicating by this, according to the Daily Times of Pakistan, the U.S. may not object to President Musharraf's election for another term in uniform. We cannot do anything in this regard, the U.S. envoy said this week. Musharraf, overthrew the democratic government of Pakistan some time back, has been ruling as head general and president, and maybe managing editor as well. Also news of Pakistan, See if this sounds familiar. Al-Qaeda's leaders are holed up in a secure hideout in Pakistan, from which they are revitalizing their bruised but resilient network. Who said that? The U.S. outgoing U.S. Chief of Intelligence John Negroponte. In an unusually direct statement on the whereabouts of the militant group's top echelon, Negroponte told the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that Pakistan is the center of a web of al-Qaeda connections that stretches across the globe into Europe. They're cultivating stronger operational connections and relationships, he said, that radiate outward from their leader's secure hideout in Pakistan to affiliates throughout the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. It appeared to be the first time in congressional testimony Negroponte has singled out Pakistan as the locale for the headquarters of the network. Welcome to the club, babe. Up to now, U.S. officials have said that al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and his second-in-command are hiding somewhere along the rugged mountainous border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Negroponte did not cite either bin Laden or Zawahiri by name. It did not say where in Pakistan U.S. intelligence believes the leaders are hiding. Pakistan is our partner in the war on terror. However, it is a major source also of Islamic extremism, he said in written testimony. Eliminating the safe haven that the Taliban and other extremists have found in Pakistan's tribal areas is not sufficient to end the insurgency in Afghanistan, but it is necessary. He did note the political problems facing President Perv due to a potential for tribal rebellion and a backlash by Islamic political parties opposed to the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and Iraq. With elections scheduled expected later this year, he said, in Pakistan, the situation will become even more challenging for President Musharraf and for the U.S. So, translated, don't look for the secure havens to be fleshed out this year, because they got an election in Pakistan. It's wacky, isn't it? Gets even wackier now, ladies and gentlemen, with news from outside the bubble. Oh, what a tangled web we weave. See if you know about this. The controversial U.S. airstrike in southern Somalia missed all three top al-Qaeda members that Washington alleges are hiding out in the country. According to the Financial Times of London, quoting a senior U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity because he likes his knees as they are, he said 8 to 10 al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists were killed in Monday's attack, but he gave no details. This is the first overt U.S. military intervention in Somalia since the doomed invasion in the 1990s. We're back! The strike was criticized by the European Commission as well as the Arab League, which claimed it had killed many innocent victims. There were no accurate casualty figures. So we didn't get them. We heard that we got them. We heard in American media we got them. I don't know if we heard in American media that we didn't get them. From the Telegraph, conservative newspaper in London, President George W. Bush. Now, a little background on this. We heard after the president's speech, and there were some robust words directed at Iran and Syria, we heard from the political left that this was code for the United States already starting to build up for a war against an attack on Iran. And there was an action against some Iranians in a Iranian government facility inside Iraq this week. But the people in Washington poo-pooed the stories from the left. Now, this from the conservative newspaper in London. President George W. Bush has ordered U.S. forces to launch a military offensive against Iranian officials and Revolutionary Guard officers behind a support and funding network for fighters in Iraq. Bush signed the clandestine directive after he was given new intelligence on the scale of Iranian operations in Iraq. U.S. troops were operating under the new instructions when they raided the Iranian liaison office last week, detaining 5 men. The swoop, which was condemned by Iran and its political allies in Iraq, came less than 2 weeks after a senior Revolutionary Guard, that's Iranian, commander was seized in another raid near Baghdad with documents linked to bloodshed. It has fueled fear of direct armed clashes between U.S. forces and Iranian operatives. In a further development, U.S. intelligence has learned that the Shia-led Islamic regime in Iran is backing Sunni insurgents in Iraq, as well as the Shia clerics. Iran's policy, this is the Telegraph talking, of pursuing managed chaos in Iraq is mainly conducted by the Revolutionary Guard's Quds Force, the military's foreign arm, which also supports Hezbollah and Hamas. Sunni and Shia armed factions have for months been fighting the sectarian violence, but the top Quds commander arrested late last month was carrying documents that showed links with both sides, according to a senior official. Iran has set up a network of fake import-export companies in Iraq's Anbar province to channel funds to Sunni fighters, the Sunday Telegraph has learned. Iran. Thousands of Shia militiamen have reportedly traveled to Iran for training and indoctrination. You see, the Iranians, right next door to the Iraqis, are interfering. We're half a world away, we're helping. Meanwhile, also from outside the bubble, also from the Telegraph, a lack of political direction, a shortage of soldiers, and complete disconnection between the British Foreign Office and the Ministry of Defense have combined to hinder progress in the war in Afghanistan, from a report by British military chiefs. The report, the first official assessment of the conflict, says it suffered from a, quote, lack of early political direction. It states in clear and precise terms that the forces sent to Afghanistan could have achieved more and suffered fewer casualties if greater numbers of troops had gone in at the start. Sound familiar? The report doesn't specify how many extra troops. Senior commanders say the initial force of 3,500 needed at least a further 1,000, together with extra helicopter and support units. The officer who's seen the report said 60 years after the Second World War, senior commanders and ministers had ignored a maxim by British Field Marshal Viscount Slim. Can that be right, Viscount Slim? That's what it says here. Could be a misprint. The maxim, though, is the important point here. Maxim apparently came out of the Second World War, as British Field Marshal. Quote, the more you use, the less you lose. Apparently, maxim ignored by Donald Rumsfeld as well. The defense secretary at the time, after the deployment was announced, consistently denied that the force was under strength, despite high-level unofficial briefings in which senior officers said commanders needed extra infantry, helicopters, and logistics troops. The new report concludes the deployment into Afghanistan was too slow, the troops arriving in dribbles. Those are military convoys, aren't they? The dribble. Rather than in large numbers, because of a lack of transport aircraft. And finally, news from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. How's Paul Wolfowitz doing at the World Bank? Paul, Iraq has no history of ethnic strife, Wolfowitz. This according to Bloomberg News. He faces mounting criticism from directors of the International Lending Organization who say he relies on a coterie of political advisors with little expertise in development while driving away seasoned managers. Half of the bank's 29 highest-level executives have departed since Wolfowitz, an architect of the war, took office in June 2005. The 30-year World Bank veteran Christian Poortman left in September. It was very sad to see someone of Mr. Portman's caliber leaving, says one of the 24 executive directors who oversee the management of the bank. The bank needs to be very careful not to lose too much of its human capital. The exodus is damaging the world's leading poverty-fighting institution, says Bloomberg. Directors of the bank who spoke on condition of anonymity because they like their knees, said they are concerned governments might be less willing to contribute because of unhappiness with Wolfowitz. New faces include counselor to the president, Robin Cleveland. He was associate director of the White House Office of Management and Budget and helped secure congressional funding for the war in Iraq. Kevin Kellums, a former spokesman for Vice President Cheney, was named Director of External Strategy at the bank. Wolfowitz has placed considerably more trust in a small group of outsiders from the Republican Party than in the seasoned experts in the bank, says the head of the World Bank Staff Association, representing more than 13,000 employees. The changes under Wolfowitz are unprecedented in the calculated manner in which inexperienced or ideological replacements are being placed in senior positions, says that spokesperson for the Employees Association. One of the points at issue, the push to beef up the World Bank's presence in Iraq, the subject with clashes with officials over safety. The German government has been very skeptical of the bank operating in Iraq because of the danger, says the director of the bank, who's German. So, ladies and gentlemen, some consistency in the way these people do their business. News from outside the bubble. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. It's the grown-ups in charge. Relax.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. Think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds, getting so much resistance from behind. I think it's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Somebody talk to me. What a field day gonna be. A million people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs. Those that say hooray for our side.
This is Le Show. I guess those new assumptions mean the White House is taking a gloomy, defeatist view of the situation in Iraq? Could that possibly be? It's because of the media. Ladies and gentlemen, Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman blasted the Bush administration last spring for failing to cooperate in the Senate's investigation of the response to Hurricane Katrina. Now he's in a key position to press the investigation, but he's refusing to do so. Spokeswoman Leslie Phillips said Friday that Lieberman, the new chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, will not issue subpoenas to the White House, a step he called for less than a year ago. The senator believes, his spokesperson doesn't talk like the senator. The senator believes a more productive use of his time and that of his staff is to make sure legislative fixes are implemented and ensure that response to a future catastrophe is better. Yeah. Of course, how would you know what to fix? Pardon me. I'll go back to the statement. The senator feels the American public has already concluded that the White House response was sorely lacking. Rather than take on the White House and open an old fight, he believes he can be more productive by moving forward. Lieberman was less accommodating last May when he issued a blistering addendum to the committee's report, Hurricane Katrina, A Nation Still Unprepared. In it, Lieberman accused the Bush administration of withholding details about what top officials were doing as the hurricane arrived and flooded, resulted in the flooding of most of New Orleans. At the time, Lieberman wrote that the lack of information left critical questions about disaster preparedness and response unanswered. There are matters that we could not fully explore because of agency administrative recalcitrance and, in some cases, intransigence, he wrote in the report. Only through a thorough and comprehensive investigation of what went wrong could we be assured that the government will know what steps are necessary to get it right the next time. He was also critical at the time of a decision by the then chairperson of the committee, Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, not to issue subpoenas for the information. Well, we knew he was a flop before. Now it's a flip flop. Ladies and gentlemen, also news of nuclear waste. Storing high-level nuclear waste without any leakage over thousands of years. Hey, that's a snap, isn't it? Because it's so easy for us to make sure nothing goes wrong just in the regular human lifespan. Well, now it may be harder than experts have thought, research published in the journal Nature shows. Ian Farnan of Cambridge University and his co-workers found that radiation emitted from nuclear waste could transform one possible storage material into less durable glass after just 1,400 years, much more quickly than previously thought. Current plans for disposal of some of the most dangerous material generated in nuclear power plants, such as radioactive elements extracted from spent fuel rods, have one common strategy: to encase the waste in a hard crystalline ceramic material, a kind of synthetic rock, and then put it in steel canisters and bury them in underground cavities. Because many of these radioactive substances continue putting out radiation for a very long time, the containment must persist, well, let's say in the case of plutonium-239, one of the most deadly byproducts of nuclear power, the containment must persist for at least a half-life of 24,000 years. That's when only half of the initial batch is decayed. Ideally, it should stay put for 10 times as long, a quarter of a million years. That's easy. That's a snap. Farnan and his colleagues have investigated one possible material hoped to do the job, called zirconium sulfate, silicate. This would supposedly hold on to the radioactive atoms and stop them from finding their way into the environment. However, the problem is, there's a problem. Radioactive waste damages the matrix that contains it. Many of the waste substances, including plutonium-239, emit alpha radiation, traveling for only a very short distance, but creating havoc along the way. Back to the drawing board, boys. But it's the clean fuel of the future. Today. And now, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go to this. This is from the Found Objects Department. Good thinking. The Found Objects Department brings forth this piece of material As you know, the president delivered his speech on the new way forward this week, and the television networks, well, they didn't fall all over themselves to cover it. They did cover it. They skedaddled back to regular entertainment programming without waiting for the Democratic reply, such as it was. But, you know, the network anchors did need to have a little time after the speech to perhaps question their correspondents, engage in some terse but cogent colloquy. And CBS News anchor Katie Couric needed to prepare for the task by finding out exactly what questions she should ask her corps of correspondents.
And do you guys know what Axelrod wants to be asked?
And we have questions. And we
can you just tell me, just so I know?
Sure. What's the president's next move to sell the plan?
Okay. How will the president sell this plan?
Right. And then for Bob, it's the battle lines are on Capitol Hill. What's the next move for the opponents, those who oppose the plan? And then for Mark,
2 minutes out, 2 minutes.
Could this lead to higher casualties? And how much time do military planners think they have to make it work?
How long will the deployment last? Or something?
No, it's not that. It's how long are the Pentagon planners giving it to work?
So okay.
What's the window?
Okay.
And they have to know that it worked.
Okay. And then where will I go?
Forger.
And what's her question? Sorry.
What's the biggest surprise to you in the speech?
Okay. And then what's after that?
Bob again.
Bob. Okay. And what's Bob want to talk about?
Is he in danger of being isolated politically?
Yeah.
Well, 1 minute.
I can say they told us he's really sticking his neck out.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Is he isolated? I don't know. Really sticking.
I'll think about something.
Yeah.
Give you an idea when we're in
this. I'd love Jim Axelrod to give us some atmospherics about, like, or was the White House really nervous about this? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
No. How much pressure does the president feel? Did the president feel going into this speech? Don't you think that's a good question for Jim?
I think it's a great question because it's all about feelings. And that's what we really care about here in America. But lest you think, ladies and gentlemen, that Katie, you know, needed to be coached on these questions and wasn't doing any of her own thinking, she surely is.
5, 4, 3, 2...
That's the CBS Evening News for tonight. I'm Katie Couric in Washington. Thanks for watching. I'll see you tomorrow from New York. Good night.
And now the 9:30 goodbye.
No, do you think I could say one time, night, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite? No, I'm kidding.
See, she's thinking all the time.
What would you do if I told you that some things aren't worth anything? And would your world turn or would you stand by everything that you believe in? You're living on what went before you. That's something that we all do. Don't leave it too late to find out, to sort out the stranger who's inside. 'Cause there are no straight roads to happiness, the road must bend. And there is no one path to seek the truth, each path must end somewhere. And I tell you, 'cause I love you, and you're hurting again. 'Cause I'm your best. And friends like us don't happen too often or too easily. We share the same compassions, evasions, and conspiracies. And I never liked the fashion for saying what comes easy. Bathmaster in somewhere. I tell you, cause I love you, and we're hurting again. Cause I'm your best, your best friend. Your best friend. And what would you do if I told you? What would you do if I told you some things aren't worth anything at all?
This is Le Show. Time for one of our nutty phone-in features that we do from time to time. Today, wacky New Year's resolutions. Really like to hear what you've got on tap for the new year. So, we have a call already on our newsmaker line. Let's all right. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Scherer.
That is a very familiar
yes.
voice.
Yes, Mr. Scherer, this is Shab Shab.
Shab Shab, okay.
Yes.
Thank you for the help there.
You're welcome.
Shab Shab is an occasional caller to this broadcast, has been for several years. We met him when he was in the news as one of the, I think, 23 or 32 Saddam Hussein
yes.
lookalikes that Saddam had used during his reign in power.
Yes, sir.
Shab Shab, I've had a lot of listeners asking what's been happening with you lately, so it's good to hear from you.
Mr. Scherer, I've been wondering what's happening to me lately. to tell you the truth, sir,
yes.
It's been, as I told you last time,
yeah.
Ever since Saddam was imprisoned, found in the spider hole, so-called,
mm-hmm.
I say so-called because you look in that hole, sir,
yes.
and I have relatives who have done so. Uh-huh. There were no spiders in that hole.
Okay, but just to get back to the main point.
Plenty of flies.
Yes.
No spiders.
Okay.
But yes, sir, it's been difficult for me. I did parties. I appeared at weddings to mm-hmm. give the bride away or mm-hmm. to take back whatever they wanted. But obviously, as time went on and became more well known that Saddam was in prison, the demand for Saddam lookalikes, it fell. It plummeted, sir, because everybody knew he couldn't be at the wedding. He couldn't be at the party, so the illusion is destroyed.
Yeah, but weren't people in Shiite neighborhoods, for example,
no.
not to get too sectarian about it, just delighted to hire you and maybe, I don't know, throw things at you?
Mr. Scherer, mm-hmm. I was not a piñata to be used for the amusement of people who are Saddam's enemies. I was an entertainer. Yeah. I was a professional entertainer, sir. You of all people should understand the difference.
Well,
so, yes, I withdrew to my neighborhood with my co-religionists, as it turned out,
mm-hmm.
and catered to those of them who still wanted to buy high-end audio equipment in a city that has 2 hours of electricity. You figure it out.
Well, I would say that means you're selling a lot of surge protectors, too.
Mr. Scherer, please. It's far too late in the game to joke with me.
Well,
high-end audio equipment has built-in surge protection, sir. You know this.
I didn't know that.
Oh, please.
But, all right, so Shab Shab, the offers for work as a Saddam lookalike had dwindled to a precious few.
Yes, sir.
I'm sure that the execution must have put, so to speak, a serious damper on your business.
You mean the so-called execution?
The so-called execution?
Yes, sir.
I think we all saw it on TV, Shab Shab.
Mr. Scherer, mm-hmm. please. We are grown-ups here.
Right.
You must have asked yourself at one point in last week or two, how come all these different videos keep emerging? And now there are two people with cell phones
yeah.
taking videos according to a witness that suddenly surfaces and talks to the BBC
yeah.
this very week,
I
Mr. Schrader.
I saw that.
You have to recognize a charade when you see one, sir.
A charade?
A charade, sir.
All right. Shab Shab, you seem to be suggesting that Saddam Hussein wasn't, in fact, executed the way that we were led to believe.
Mr. Ferrier, you get to the point, finally.
Well,
yes, sir, I'm suggesting that your eyes deceived you, as, of course, they do time and time again. I know this from the inside, sir. I was given the offer personally to be in the noose.
Wait a minute. You were offered...
Yes, sir.
What, the job of being Saddam Hussein at the execution? What kind of an offer is that?
Yes, sir. It's a very good offer indeed. It was a very good offer indeed. It would have the money that was being discussed would have made your Simpson salary look like chump change, as we say.
Shab, we don't want to go there.
All right.
What exactly are you saying? You were offered a large sum of money.
Yes, sir.
To sit in for Saddam Hussein,
yes,
at his execution.
Yes, sir.
And you turned it down.
Of course I did. I'm standing here talking to you now.
All right, maybe you should sit down. But your reason for turning down the offer was...
What I like to live, Mr. Ferrier. Mm. It's a tough life. It's a difficult life. It's a challenging life.
Yes.
But there are new tube amps coming from Belarus within the next 6 weeks.
Mm.
The 7,000 series. I have high hopes for them. I want to see how well they sell. If, you know, inshallah, we get 3 hours of electricity a day.
All right. That's an interesting portent for the future.
Yes.
But are you suggesting, therefore, that... one of the 32 Saddam lookalikes was the person we saw in the videos?
Mr. Ferrier, I'm suggesting nothing.
Right.
Of course. I'm sure they just came to me with this offer, and when I said no, they said, oh, well, let's give up. Let's shrug our shoulders and slink away into the night. What are we talking about here?
All right. So who were the people that made you this offer, Shab?
Sir, I've already told you I don't want to die for seven figures. Certainly, I don't want to do it for free on your public radio, do I?
No, I guess you don't.
No, I don't.
So, were you happy when you saw Saddam Hussein or whoever being executed? And is that now, do you think, in the weeks since, has that been good for your business?
Was I happy?
Mm-hmm.
That was your question.
That was my question.
This was a tragedy for Iraq, sir.
Hmm.
We put out video that looks dark and grainy.
Grainy.
Shot from the wrong angle, sir.
Well,
it makes us look like we cannot do anything in this technological age.
Mm-hmm.
A 12-year-old in your high schools can make better-looking video and put it on YouTube. And we are supposedly a sovereign nation, one of the great civilizations of the world.
Of course.
And we put out video that looks like this.
Well,
please, Mr. Ferrier.
Yeah.
But yes, in answer to your second question, now there is a burgeoning demand for Saddam lookalikes.
Really?
The few social gatherings that still exist. I come in, they say, oh, he's alive, oh, he's alive, inshallah, he's alive. And there's much merriment and cakes.
Merriment cakes. Well, you can't beat that. So things are good for you again, Shab, or is the situation that... you having received this offer and turned it down, are you in any fear for your life?
Mr. Ferrier, every single one of us in this country is in fear every day.
Mm.
That's called normal life.
Well.
But there are 24 of us. I don't want to give an exact figure. I don't know the exact figure,
no.
Or maybe I do, but I don't want to say it.
All right.
That did get this offer and refused it. We are all under the microscope, so to speak, but the microscopes have been smashed, if you know what I mean.
Boy, I really don't know what you mean, but it's good to hear from you. It's good to know that the tube amps from Belarus are coming in and that you're bringing forth merriment and cakes.
Yes,
Shab, thank you for calling in on the Newsmaker line. By the way, do you have any New Year's resolutions for this year?
Yes, sir. Hmm. It's to get digital cable.
All right. You really want to make those 3 hours of electricity pay off for you.
Yes, I do.
All right. Thank you, Shab, from somewhere in Iraq,
somewhere,
for calling in. Good luck to you and take care.
You too, Mr. Ferrier. Bye-bye.
Shab on our Newsmaker line here on Le Show.
Monday night, our continuing story of broken borders and exporting America crosses a dramatic new threshold.
I'm Rajiv Rajeshpuran in Bangalore, where Time Warner today announced it's outsourcing the anchoring of CNN's Ulu Dobbs Tonight program.
Rajiv, does this mean that anchors such as myself are out of a job?
Lou, this isn't about anchors such as yourself. This is about you and no. You're not out of a job as long as you agree to move to Bangalore.
And accept the local prevailing wage.
For anchors.
But Rajiv, I cover what's happening to America, to its borders, to its jobs, to its economy. New York is the financial capital of the world. Seems to me I have to be here.
Lou, it seems that way to you, but it may not seem that way to Time Warner executives. Oh, it's all available on the internet anyway.
Join me Monday night when the news hits home. And I'm not just pretending to be pissed anymore.
And Lou, tentatively, pending your decision to move, your replacement looks like it's going to be me.
It's time for answers. Monday night.
I'm changing my name to Lou.
Ladies and gentlemen, news of failing upward. The second-in-command at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, during its much-criticized response to Hurricane Katrina, started a new job this week, a senior job at NASA. I know it sounds like a joke. Patrick Rode, who was chief of staff and deputy director of FEMA under Michael Brown, was hired as a senior advisor to NASA Administrator Michael Griffin on communication issues. Rode is a former television reporter who was an advance man for the 2000 Bush-Cheney campaign. The hiring was done by the White House and Griffin of NASA working together. I'm glad I could get some people together. Rode's name emerged in an embarrassing email exchange between him and Brown just hours after Katrina struck New Orleans. When asked if he was available for a phone call, Brown said he was sitting in the chair putting mousse in my hair, and Rode chimed in, "Me too." Rode's appointment was first reported on a website, could not be reached for comment by phone or email. But a NASA spokesperson said he was qualified for the NASA job, commenting, quote, "He's done a lot of things," unquote. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave on channel 133 at XM satellite radio on the big mighty 104 in Berlin, available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like all of us being hired, because we've done a lot of things, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the Pittsburgh and San Diego desks. Playlists are available for this broadcast at harryshearer.com, which also has an email address you can use to reach the host. Reach but not touch. My thanks to everybody who came out to the book signings here in the Southern California area this week. Didn't have time to promote them on the broadcast, but you came anyway. Thank you for that. And maybe I'll see you on the Letterman Show this week, or maybe not. We'll see. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.